reading the introduction to the Grahams that's in their prayer card here. They grew up in Christian homes, Robert in Detroit, although I understand you have Canadian roots before that in the Windsor area, as far as your ancestors. Janice in Toronto. They both developed a close relationship with the Lord at a young age and were led towards mission work with First Nations people. Bob's an ordained minister with EMCC, earned a BRE at Tyndale and an MDiv at Anderson School of Theology, which incidentally is the Church of God school at Anderson, Indiana. So like, we share summer services with Church of God, and that's the church that Bob was originally ordained with. Janice received a BA from the University of Western Ontario and a B.Ed. at Nipissing University, and she has some teaching experience as well. Robert pastored First Nations churches in the U.S. Janice taught school and led DVBS work with First Nations. Both have been involved in camp ministry, Bible study, and worship. And recently, the Grahams have been working with Living Hope Native Ministries, which was formerly called Impact North. They minister with Circle of Friends Native Christian Fellowship in the North Bay area. Their disciple-making ministry includes relationship building through prayer and Bible study, community outreach, prison ministry, tutoring, and interaction with university college students and social events. And they come a long way to be with us today, coming from North Bay area. Is it like four and a half hours, something like that? 5 hours? So they drove down yesterday, and we got to know them a little bit last night when they were staying over at our place. But they got a long way to head back today as well. And so we appreciate the effort you've gone to already just to be here this morning with us. And pray God's Spirit will be on you and bless you as you speak. Please welcome them this morning.
It is a privilege, honor, and it's great to be here. This morning, we're going to take a look at what I've entitled my sermon, Missions Old Testament Style. Because in the Old Testament, you have a lot of cultural similarities with First Nations people. We already read our text this morning, and that was the story of Naaman. And Naaman was a commander, a general in the army of Aram, which really is Syria. Aram later became Syria. And even today, Israel and Syria are always fighting. And it was no different back then. And Syria defeated Israel. So, what did Syria do? Like all countries back then that defeated another country, they took slaves. And one of these slaves, one of these slave girls, were given to Naaman's wife as her servant. Well, we also see, and this will come later in the story, that he took more than this slave girl. There was, Josephus says that Naaman probably had 15 to 20 Jewish slaves in his household. Well, Naaman became leprous, and we see in our story that the slave girl told her master, told his wife, to go and see Elijah. Now, I want you to think about something here. This slave girl had credibility. She told Naaman's wife that Naaman should go and see Elijah to be healed. Now, leprosy was a disease that was a death warrant back then. There was no cure. And once you were a leper, you had no hope. In fact, it was one of the worst kinds of diseases you could have. Because what did they do to leopards? They excluded them from the community. They excluded them from family. We see even in Jesus' time, when lepers were about, if somebody came within 50 feet of them, they would have to yell, "Unclean, unclean! Get away, get away!" So it was a lonely death. It was a lonely disease. They had nobody come and comfort them. They had no family there. And this is what Naaman had, this terrible disease. And here is this slave girl, this Jewish believer, says to his wife, "Go and see Elijah." And she had so much credibility because the way she lived in front of Naaman and his wife, guess what? They decided they had to go and see Elijah. They believed her. Wouldn't it be nice if we had that same credibility in the world? That when if we told somebody they needed Jesus or Jesus was the answer to their problem, they would say, "If you say so, yes, I want Jesus." This is the kind of credibility the slave girl had. This is the kind of life she lived in front of her masters. So Naaman, what does he do? He goes to Elijah. Now, our text says Elijah tells him to go and dip 7 times in the river. And so Naaman goes to Elijah, and Elijah tells him to go and dip 7 times in the Jordan. And what happens with Naaman? It says he becomes furious. He becomes angry. He is mad. And why would Naaman become mad? Well, he's animistic. And what is animism? Traditional First Nations religion is animistic. What is animism? What do animists believe? Well, the first thing is that everything has a spirit. This stand here has a spirit. The walls have a spirit. You have a spirit. The trees and the grass have a spirit. The animals outside have a spirit. Everything has a spirit. And what animism says is that you can manipulate the spirits to do what you want through ritual or ceremony. And if you have the right ritual or the right ceremony, then the spirits will do whatever you want those spirits to do. That's what a shaman is. What does a shaman do? Or a medicine man? Or in Africa, the witch doctor? They study the ceremonies and the rituals that will manipulate certain spirits. And then, if they have the right ritual or ceremony, those spirits have to do what you want them to do. You know, that ultimately makes you God. It ultimately tells those spirits what you want, and they have to do it. In a sense, sometimes we see Christian animism, I like to call it, because we have these prosperity preachers who says that if you say the right prayer, God has to do what you want him to do. In fact, I have a book. I was given a book, and it was by one of these prosperity preachers that was on healing, and it's about this thick, and it has 302 different prayers. And you say the right prayer with the right disease, then God has to heal you. That's animism, saying God has to do something that we want him to do. But Naaman was animistic. He thought that Elijah would come out, do a ceremony over his body, and he would drive out through this ceremony or this ritual his leprosy. And when Elijah didn't come out, when Elijah didn't do a ceremony, when Elijah didn't do a ritual, He got mad. He got angry. Well, our text says that the servants, these are the other Jewish believers, these are his servants, came to him. And they had credibility too. See, there was a Jewish community there, a small community of faith, if you would like. And they say to Naaman, they said, if he asked you to do something great, something difficult, you would have done it, wouldn't you? They told him, and you notice they addressed him as father. There was a relation, a family relationship there. There probably was, Naaman was probably a great master, and there's probably love and some really strong emotional ties with these servants. And they said, like 13, Naaman's servants went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you have not done it? How much more then when he tells you to wash and be cleansed? You see, the servants came and told him, just go and wash and be healed. So because of the servants and what they said, he goes and he washes. And guess what? He's healed. And when he's healed, he becomes a God-fearer. But you see, it was not only, the important thing was not only the individual slave girl and how she lived, but it was also the community, how they lived in front of their master. The other thing that we see here is that there is a different worldview. And what do I mean by worldview? What do I mean by worldview? Anybody, what do I mean by worldview? Okay, how we see the world, exactly. That's what worldview means, how we see the world. Now, if you went across the globe, there's basically three worldviews. And now each worldview has a little of everyone else, but there's a predominant trait. And these three worldviews you can see in Genesis. What were the three things that Adam and Eve felt after the fall? They never felt before. But after they fell and they were confronted by God, what were some of the things they felt? Shame. It says they made clothes of figs because they felt shame after they sinned. What's another thing that they felt? Fear. They hid from God. And of course, guilt. And these three worldviews, like you have shame, honor, fear, power, guilt, innocence. You go across the world and you see these in every society. Some dominant worldview. Now, our worldview in the West, in Canada, what would you say that is? No? Well, guilt, innocence. Yes, you're right. Guilt. We really think about doing what is right. We all individual have our rights. In fact, our worldview has really, in the last 30 years, has really gone even more so to the guilt innocent view. I remember at NDP we were talking about this, and we had this older retired missionary. He was in his 70s, and he said, when I got saved, I got saved because I feared hell. And we had a lot of sermons on God's judgment and hell. and God's power. So he says, back then, there was our whole society, there was more of a fear of police, there was fear of authority. We've lost that. And instead, we center on our rights now, more so than... So our worldview has changed a little. MDP, Missionary Development Program. We went to Saskatchewan for 8 weeks, 3 years ago, and did cross-cultural training. So we're guilt innocents. If you went to the Far East, you would find that their society is fear power. Now, if you went to... There are two groups that are shame honor. And as evangelicals, as the Christian church, we have the hardest time to reach those people groups. In fact, the International Missiological Association list each year the 10 hardest people groups to reach. And all 10 of them hold a shame honor worldview. They are North American Aboriginals and mostly Arabs, Muslims. And what is a shame honor worldview? Well, you look at the world and whether you give shame or honor to people. Now, how does that play out? Well, when I first came to North Bay and I was working with some of our native friends, I would ask them if they wanted to go out for coffee. And they would always say yes. But about 40% of the time, maybe even 50% of the time, I would show up for the coffee, but they wouldn't. I found out that in a shame-honor worldview, to say no to somebody is worse than saying yes and not showing up. Because you're bringing shame on that person. And it's considered impolite to ask a closed question where you have to answer yes or no. You have to always ask an open question. Another way, I had a friend who went up north to one of the northern communities, and he was preaching, and it was an evangelistic sermon, and he had the gospel, and he had an altar call. Everybody in the whole place came forward, whether they met it or not, because if they didn't come forward, they would have been shamed on the speaker. And First Nations people are very much shame honor in their worldview. But you know, Naaman became a God-fearer. Naaman became a believer in God. And why was that? Because he just didn't see the slave girl. But he saw the difference in the life of the community. And with shame-based culture, we have not really been able to do a good job of evangelism all across the world. Missions and Christianity has done a relatively good job in evangelism, getting the word out there, but not in shame-based cultures. And what seems to start to work, and we were at a church in Saskatoon that was taking, or Regina, excuse me, that was taking a, was modeling their service, their church, from a church in the United Arab Emirates. And in the West, when we think of doing the Great Commission, we always think of doing evangelism, then we think of discipleship and community. Well, what seems to be working in Muslim churches, communities, and in Aboriginal works is you create community first. Then you, as you create community, you model and teach discipleship. And down the road comes conversion. When we were at Healing Hearts, and it's probably one of the biggest First Nations churches I've seen, they have about 150 every Sunday. The pastor said that 85% of the people there are not Christians, though they come every Sunday. They go to small groups. They're not Christians. And when he started, there was only one other Christian family that started with him. The rest have become Christians after 2 or 3 years in the community. Why is that? Because they want to see, they not only look at the individual and their integrity, but they wanted to see if the community of faith is what it says it is. Because, let's go back. You go back to the shame-honor worldview. Anything that brings shame on the family or the clan is punishable. Now, if you went to Pakistan, there would be, if you killed somebody, there would be three results. One, you would get arrested, go to trial, found guilty, and your head would get lopped off. Two, you would get arrested, go to trial, found not guilty, and you would go free. Third, it's an honor killing. What is an honor killing? An honor killing is the eldest son in the family is to protect the honor of that family, and if they don't, the clan does. And if someone in that family has violated 385 different rules that bring death, then it's the job of the elder son to kill that person. One of those things that bring such shame is conversion. Well, in First Nations circles, you don't get killed if you get converted, but they do shun you. We had a guy who came to know the Lord, and the elders went like this, turned their back on him, and they cut him off from the tribe because he was shunned. He converted. So, therefore, they look at the community. Because when they become Christians, they're going to trade one community in for another. So sometimes it's 2, 3, 4 years they're in the church before they make that commitment to Christ. Now, how are we creating community in North Bay? Well, we have Bible studies. We have a woman's Bible study. We have a men's Bible study. We have a Bible study on Wednesday nights. We will be starting Celebrate Recovery, which is it comes from Saddleback, and it's a 12-step, well, it's really a 7-step program for people that are hurt, primarily it's recovery for alcoholism, but it goes beyond that. We have prayer meetings. We have social events, camp work. We have worship services. And we make a lot of relationships. Jan's going to come up and we're going to show you some of the things we do.
As Bob was saying, we went out to Saskatchewan a few years ago to ministry development, and just prior to going out there, we had a call about camp work, and we had been involved with Awana Landing Native Bible Camp for a few years, but there was this camp up near Kirkland Lake that was available through the Renewal Fellowship of the Presbyterian Church, and the facilities were going to be made available for no cost, so we were asked if we would run a camp there, but we knew we were going to be away for a few months. Anyone who's been involved in Sunday school work or daily vacation Bible school and that sort of thing, you know that it takes a lot of time beforehand to get ready. You don't just go in there and start. And we wanted to make sure that this could be done properly. So I said, well, we're not sure this is the right year, but apparently if it wasn't going to start then, it might not start at all. So we said, perhaps somebody else could come along and help. And sure enough, Calvin Brown with the Renewal Fellowship has partnered with us as a director for Dorothy Lake Camp. So this summer is the third summer coming up for that. And that all got going just after we moved to North Bay. So this lady is one of the ladies in our Circle of Friends Fellowship in North Bay. And this is one of our first meeting times in our home after we moved. And I have the son of one of the ladies who takes part regularly in Bible studies in the middle there. And the lady on the end of the couch, Dorothy Chichu, helps me with ladies' Bible studies on Thursday afternoons. This is a couple who has come to us from Timmins. They're both attending school in North Bay, but Micheline is just about to graduate from Nipissing with a degree in sociology, and her husband is taking computer courses. And the lady in the middle is a sister to the lady you saw at the beginning, Anna, who is just very avid for Bible learning, and we've enjoyed some good studies this year in different books of the Bible, also sharing a book about God's peace in our hearts. These children are from a family that came from Manitoulin and moved to North Bay, and the mom has just finished up courses for early childhood education. And so, as you see, we have a very eclectic group. Norman again. Because this fellow is from the territories, it's Dene. And so as I explained to the children, when we think of communication in native languages, there are a number of languages. And that I was involved in language learning, not to learn the language, but to learn how to learn language when I was out at MDP, which was interesting and challenging. Something I've been trying to pursue on my own a little bit. Well, there we are. Dorothy's husband's at the table with us. Roy is from James Bay area, and we really value this couple. They're a mature Christian couple that mean so much to us. I don't think we could do the work. The Lord has just brought them alongside for us to be able to carry on the work in North Bay. It's a little dark. I'm just going to bypass that. That was just the entrance to Dorothy Lake Camp. And a nice, peaceful time of day. Again, it's a beautiful setting. It's a rustic camp with pit toilets and generators for power. But some children who were there with us last year had been taken to a computer camp before this one. And we were sitting at the table in the dining room. Dining room, it's a little exotic for where we eat, but anyway. They were saying they like our camp, because it was really camp. So I guess they get enough computers too the rest of the year. This is our group from last year. And the lady on your right is with Beaver House First Nation. She attends the Baptist Church in Kirkland Lake. And she came out and really contributed a lot to our program. She helped the children learn to make rattles using birch bark. And led in some singing, and she's just a real encouragement and help to us. And some of the children are the children of people who help with the camp as well. And the children come from the Kirkland Lake area and the Kapuskasing area. There's Bob having some one-on-one and camps about all sorts of things: swimming, canoeing, archery, crafts, Bible study, singing, games. And this is a water regatta day, one of the highlights during camp weeks. Another highlight is to take the canoes across to the far corner of the lake that you can see if going on an angle across from the raft, and then we can portage from there into another small lake and get to a place to have a campfire supper. So that's always fun. Okay, and this is some of the children with the counselor who helped us out last year, and she has been attending our South Shore church, a missionary church up our way. And there's Calvin Brown, whom I mentioned earlier, our co-director. And now, I'm sorry, another dark picture, but I don't know if Elaine Johnson Scott's been in your area. She has been with Child Evangelism. She's not currently, but she comes and does Bible teaching at camp. And so she's in that picture that you can't see very well. And she's coming back again this year. She really enjoys being with the children and working with them. And at this, in this one, there's a young fellow you saw in an earlier shot who came to us from Kapuskasing first time last year. His sister came the first year. And his sister found it a little difficult to actually have to sit and listen. And we try not to have a long sitting listening time. We try to have lots of action, and but some children find that harder than others. But at the end of camp, she gave her heart to the Lord, and when she came back last year, she was just a different girl. And her brother came, and he struggled with some of the Bible verse learning, but he really decided he wanted to get on top of that. And so by the end of the week, he went in, and Elaine worked with him, and he went through all the verses, and he came to know the Lord too. And two of these children in the background there are from reserves in the Kapuskasing area. And the lady there is from our American church and comes to do crafts and music and drama with the children. These girls are from the Kirkland Lake area, enjoying some of the crafts. Now, at our camp we have literacy, and you might wonder, how does that fit into a camp setting? But it's something that was happening at our sister camps, and I had seen it being very effective. In fact, I heard of children being in craft saying, when do we go to literacy? So the people who have been helping with this program come with tons of wonderful books, and we're not trying to teach reading, because you don't do that in a week at camp. But what you do is you come alongside a child. So we have as many staff members there at that time as possible for one-on-one. And so if they want to read aloud to that person, they do, or the other person reads to the child. And they get to explore all these books, and they find out that there's a wonderful world there. And if you can help and encourage a child that books really are an adventure, and encourage them to enjoy that when they go back to school too, and it helps them to get into God's Word, then it's a really valuable program. And for the new kids, when they first come, you know, they might walk in and think it's like a classroom too, but by the next day they know that it's a place they want to be. So the lady who is here in this picture, Lois, well, she's 76 by now. Last year was her last year. She said she didn't think she could do this, and I thought she did great to come to our camp. She had been at the other ones because, like I said, ours is, well, we sleep in a tent when we go to camp. The kids are in cabins. And she was in a trailer, but she did well. So a lady from our Niagara church has volunteered to come to camp this year and do this program. And we're looking forward to working with Brenda. Well, some of the lifeguard fellow on the side was the lifeguard some of the time. This is our cook, Scottish lady, wonderful sense of humor. She loves to tell stories and share those with the kids too. Gives us great food. There's our campfire. If you remember the building that you saw when Bob was playing catch earlier, it's almost like a teepee shape. And so this is our fire pit inside. We have an indoor campfire. And we've made bannock on sticks and cooked it over the fire. Well, not that kind of fire, but cooking fire. And this is our main building at this camp. So the first year, this is just the third year coming up. First year we had junior camp, ages 8 to 12. And then we were asked to add teen camp last year. And the word went out all through the northern reserves and towns. Posters were up, and people, there were some conversations about it. And we knew for junior camp that the kids who had come the first year had also their coming back. And then we had some more. And they didn't send their applications before camp either, but word of mouth said they were coming, so that's fine. They brought their forms when camp started. But teen camp was new, and we didn't have that kind of feedback, and we didn't have any application forms. And a couple who had come to help us the first year had taken time off work, arrived on Friday before camp, and we said, we don't know who's coming. We don't know if we're having camp. We went to church on Sunday with the lady that you saw from Beaver House First Nation, said, well, I think you're going to have a few. And she gave us the list and then made some phone calls. And Monday morning, two fellows arrived. We had been thinking if we had six, we could start camp. Monday evening, we had seven. And they're all guys, all teens. And we had a wonderful week with them. I really enjoyed them. And some of them are more expert at archery, I think, than the people leading that, because they've had life experience with it. And with the First Nations group at Kirkland Lake, they'll be in town in the wintertime and on reserve in the summertime. And some have actually still been out, you know, using bow and arrow, not very commonly anymore, but some have. And Rob Diltz on the left there, he graduated from Emmanuel Bible College last year, right? And he has a heart, along with his wife, for Native work. So they're looking for the Lord's leading as to where and when and how to go about that full time. They've helped us at camp. And I like canoeing, but I just, canoeing, kayaking, I just have a new kayak that I can enjoy. So I had one before when my kids were little. There was a two-person one, only with, I put the two kids in the back and I'd go. And it got too big. So recently I've been able to get a small one I can take by myself. But I didn't go on the canoe trip, which was added last year. And Bob's going to tell you about that.
One of the things that we found in Aboriginal churches is that there is a lack of young leadership. It seems that everybody, almost every Aboriginal church I know, probably with the exception of Healing Hearts, the leadership is in their 70s and 80s. And you go into a church, you'll see a lot of children, a lot of kids under 18. But it seems once they reach 18, 19, 20, they're gone. And a generation has been lost. So what we decided to do is we have what we call a canoe camp. And we take the cream of the crop from our staff and from our campers. They are our teen campers. They have to be at least 16 to go on this. And we take them out to down the Pickle River system. And we concentrate on character development and leadership. And here we are, we're starting our our 4.5 paddle into 4.5 hour paddle to our campgrounds. The closest building to where we camp is a fly-in hunt and fishing camp, which is a 45-minute paddle back. So we're out in nowhere. Here's our first portage, and in that houseboat is this older man. He came out here, and he must be in his 70s. He comes out every summer from April to hunting season, and he just lives there on the lake. And a very interesting guy to talk to. He sort of reminds me of the old mountain men trappers back you would see back in the 1800s. This is our portage. We started to put up tents, and we inspire teamwork and leadership. And then last year, it started to rain. And it rained. And it rained. I'll tell you, we were in our tent, and about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, I get woken up because the rain is hitting so hard on our tent. Well, I get back to sleep. About an hour and a half later, I woke up drip, 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 drip on my face. By 7 o'clock when we woke up, every sink is soaked. Sleeping bags, everything. And the wind is howling, and it's coming down. And you see they're holding the poles. We had to hold the poles for the tarps to get a fire started, the wind, so that we could have some cover so we could have a fire. There is some of there's some of the rain there. Usually we'd have gotten broken camp and left, but it was raining so hard and we saw some lightning that we decided that we couldn't be out on the lake. So we just stayed there. And in the afternoon we went exploring with the kids all around some islands and some lakes that were by there. And this is somebody that was remodeling an old hunt camp. And here's where I was speaking. We had times where we talked about character development. We talked about truth. What is truth? We talked about leadership. And basically, I led those sessions. And then here's our group that went. This is just before we left. Broke up as we're back from our canoe camp. It's been a pleasure to share with you this morning. I appreciate it. We appreciate it.
Yes, make which. Thank you. And we really appreciate your prayers as well. Thanks very much.